So, last time and this time we'll be looking sort of at a basic digital communication system model. So, what are the steps you need to go through to take some sort of signal or message and transmit it over a distance via a radio system? Okay. And so we've gone through a number of those steps. What we'll be concentrating on today is, well, two things. We're going to look at sort of a specific modulation technique that's used for radio systems, the spread spectrum technique. And then we're going to look at the properties of this radio channel, okay? And to some extent, it's hard to know exactly where to put spread spectrum. It might make a little more sense after you discuss what the properties of the radio channel are. On the other hand, it is also a modulation technique, and it's pretty straightforward to deal with as a modulation technique. So we're going to start there. Okay, so last time we looked at, again, some of these other blocks. We looked at source encoding, and specifically, how would you encode voice? And again, you ended up having anything from a 64 kilobit per second sort of nice encoding down to a few kilobits per second, which would not give you great quality, but again would still be intelligible. Okay. Channel encoding is just essentially handling packet errors or bitstream errors, and we didn't say a whole lot about it except just to define it. We would assume that that's something you'd see in a basic networks course. And then we looked at various modulation techniques. Again, they're probably something you'd see in a basic networks course, but again, they have a bearing on radio systems in particular. Okay, so for each of these, what we saw is that they had either a positive or a negative, depending on how you look at it, effect on the ability of the receiver to decode the signal and to reproduce what was the original signal at the sending end. Okay. And again, if you think of source encoding, we've already said, if you use your 64 kilobit per second representation, you're pretty close to your original signal. If you use something less than that, you're less close to it. You would hope that channel encoding, so error handling, you would hope that that would improve the intelligibility of the signal. And modulation, again, certain modulation techniques are easier to recover the signal from than others. Okay. So, all of these effects can be summarized as an impact on the signal-to-noise ratio or the bitwise version of that signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, so the EB over N0. So signal-to-noise would be sort of at a sort of instant in time. EB is over the duration of a bit. And we had a look at how that impacted channel capacity through the Shannon channel capacity theorem, or Shannon's capacity theorem, and then bandwidth deficiency. So what sort of bit rate could you get relative to the bandwidth available to you? So we are going to, excuse me, now look at a modulation technique that is pretty much specific to radio systems, and it's designed to sort of ameliorate some of the effects that you find in some of the channel effects you find in radio systems that can have negative impact on the signal quality, which again we can characterize in the signal to noise ratio. Okay. And so, we'll cover that, then we'll probably take a little break and come back and then look at the radio channel itself. Okay. So, the basic idea of spread spectrum is that narrowband signals can be quite bad in radio systems. There are channel effects that can impact sort of very specific frequency ranges, and if you happen to be on one of those, you're sort of out of luck. And due to characteristics of mobility and radio channels and sort of how difficult it is to predict the channel, you can't even predict sort of which bits are going to be bad. Okay. So it's often desirable in radio channels to spread your bandwidth sort of as widely as possible. Now, you might say, well, if you spread your bandwidth out, sort of, how can you share your channels efficiently? So if one signal is sort of spread over the entire bandwidth of the channel, how do you share it? But we will look at techniques then that we can use to, even within this spreading of the signal, to also facilitate the sharing of the bandwidth. Okay, but so the basic idea of the technique is that we take this narrow bandwidth signal and the modulator is going to spread the bandwidth. Okay, and so this is accomplished by means of a spreading code. So we have sort of a specific key or chip sequence, it's called, that will tell us how we are spreading our bandwidth, and then the receiver at the other end has to know what code is used, and knowing the code, it can recover the signal that was originally sent. We hope. Okay. So we'll look at two techniques. One's used with frequency shift keying, one with phase shift keying. And again, both achieve the same goal of sort of spreading out your bandwidth. Okay, so the first technique we'll look at is frequency hopping spread spectrum. And it works by changing the base frequency of the signal at a periodic interval. Okay. So you subdivide your channel into a number of carrier frequencies, so a number of subchannels, and then each of these subchannels has to have the bandwidth to facilitate your initial frequency shift keying modulation. Okay. And so when transmitting, the transmitter will sort of operate on one subchannel for a period of time, and then it will jump to another subchannel. And so it'll move around which subchannel it's using. Okay. So you start out, again, you modulate your signal. Then you combine it with our chipping signal or our spreading code, which is C of T in this diagram. And then that signal is filtered, transmitted, and at the other ends, the same C of T, the same chipping signal, is used to decode it, filter it, and extract the original signal. Okay. So, taking a look at that process mathematically, for frequency shift keying, and again, this is here we'd have two frequencies that we're using, and so you have a sinusoid that's being transmitted at one of these two frequencies, and that gives you your original modulated signal SD. Okay. Now, again, we want to move that signal into different frequency bands, and we use our function CT to do that. So CT is, again, just the sinusoid that we multiply our PT by, and FI is the carrier frequency that we're operating on at any given point. So you can use your usual sort of trigonometric identities to get a term for that signal that we're going to transmit. And again, it's in terms of our original frequency, then shifted into our carrier channel. Okay. And so we get a plus and a minus term, and we can use the filter to get rid of our difference term. So we're left with, again, just one signal with the frequency shifted. Okay. Now at the other end, at the receiver, again, we apply this C of T again, and now we're going to want that difference because the difference will get us back down to our original signal. And so, again, we see that we get two terms, one at, again, our original frequency, and then one at the frequency plus 2FI. And again, we can use a filter to eliminate the summed frequency and recover the original frequency. Okay, so again, that's just sort of how it works, sort of how you would think about implementing it. Obviously, you can do this for a multi-level frequency shift keying modulation scheme. The same thing's going to happen no matter how many sort of initial bands you have. You can shift them into these different carrier frequency slots. Okay. Now, usually, these schemes are characterized according to how fast we hop, so how fast we change our subchannel versus how fast we're changing our signal. Okay, and so it's characterized as a slow system, a slow frequency hop spread system. Spread spectrum system, if we're changing our signal multiple times per one change of carrier frequency. Okay, so that means you can get, you have multiple bits transmitted in the time it takes to hop. The opposite is a fast frequency hop spread spectrum system, where you hop multiple times per signal. Okay, so in that case, again, if you think of just transmitting one bit per signal, then you're having multiple hops per bit. Okay. And so if we look at an example of each, again, we have our overall system bandwidth is given by WS, and we have broken that up into four subchannels, okay? And it's those subchannels that you're going to hop along. Now, each signal is representing two bits, and we are hopping every two signals. Okay, so again, that's slow. You get two signals in for each hop, and therefore four bits are transmitted per hop. Okay, so again, if we look, we have our, if you look at any given subchannel, you have your original modulation, your original frequency shift keying going on within that subchannel. So we start out, our chipping signal is 00, so we're going to be in our lowest frequency band there, our subchannel 0 if you want. And within that, again, we're transmitting 4 bits, 00, which is, again, our lowest frequency, followed by 11, our highest frequency. Okay, moving on, obviously, the next time our subchannel is given by our chipping sequence, or our we'll see what's called PN sequence later, and we are now in the third subchannel, and then within that subchannel, we're signaling twice. The first signal is to send a 1 and a 0, so that gets you up to your third band there, and the second signal is to send a 1-1, so you're at your highest, your fourth band there. Okay, and you continue on like that. Okay. Again, in fast frequency hop spread spectrum, we have multiple hops going on per signal. So here, again, our signals are in blocks of two. So we have 00, then 11, then 10, then 11. And so the modulation will be occurring according to that group of two bits. However, we're now, for any signal, so for any two bits transmitted, one signal, two bits, we also have two hops. Okay. So we see that just in the first time slot, so the first signal transmission, our modulation, again, we're modulating 00, so it ends up in our lowest frequency band. But then we hop from the 00 subchannel, so our lowest subchannel, to the 10 subchannel, so our third subchannel. Okay. And then in terms of modulation, we're in the second band there, we're signaling, we're sending our second signal, which is to represent 1-1 now. And so 1-1 will put you in the highest band for the modulation. And then, again, you hop twice. Your first hop takes you to subchannel 1-1, which is our highest subchannel. The second hop takes you to the subchannel 1-0, so the next subchannel. Okay. So, typically, when these systems are implemented, you try to insert a lot of these subchannels so you can hop around a good range of the spectrum. What's going to limit your subchannels, again, is what's the bandwidth of your, or what's the bandwidth of your channel, and then that has to be compared to the bandwidth requirement of your of your initial signaling scheme, your initial modulation scheme. Okay. So each of these requires a certain amount of bandwidth to operate in, and so you can only fit so many subchannels in according to that bandwidth. But typically, you'll get a good few subchannels in. Okay. And so, what we say is that, or what this allows is that you get a good resistance to noise and jamming. And specifically, what you're assuming is that either jamming or noise is not occurring uniformly along the entire frequency spectrum of your channel. Okay, so some bits might be bad, and some bits are good. Typically, you'll get the sort of radio channel effect, so that you'll get sort of very narrow bands of poor transmission, and then wider bands of better transmission. Okay. And so, again, with jamming, again, the idea is that you force your opponent to try, they have to try and jam along the entire spectrum, and so they either have to expend the same power for each component of the spectrum that they would have for, again, the narrow segment, or if they only have a fixed amount of power, they have to try and spread that out over the entire bandwidth instead of, again, a very narrow segment of it. Okay. So, yeah, that's essentially what we say here. If you're using frequency hopping, then the jammer has to try and jam all the frequencies. Again, they have to now try and jam over all of WS instead of just one WD, and that's going to, again, dilute the power. If they have a fixed power, you're diluted by the number of subchannels that you've fitted in for your frequency hopping technique. Okay. So now our second technique is used with binary phase shift keying, and essentially what it does is it increases the bit rate at which the bits are transmitted, or at which it increases the signaling rate, and increasing the signaling rate again has the effect of spreading out the bandwidth. Now, the way it does this is by using a code to represent each bit as a sequence of bits. Okay. And so, again, we have our initial data stream. Now, we can think of our chipping sequence or our PN sequence as being a sequence of bits that we define, that we produce, and that runs at some higher rate than our initial data input. Okay. Then we can combine our data input with our chipping sequence, and again, we get a transmitted signal at this higher data rate. The nice thing is that at the opposite end, at the receiver, if we know this chipping sequence, we can then decode the received signal using this chipping sequence and recover the initial signal. Okay, so if we look at this example here again, we can you combine your signal using an exclusive OR, and then again extract the signal by again exclusive ORing. Now, this is used in conjunction with binary phase shift keying. So here we're going to use plus and, essentially we're using plus and minus to represent our bits, our zeros, and our zero or our one. So a phase shift of 180 degrees. Okay. And so that, again, can be represented as a sinusoidal wave. Now, the exclusive ORing, and it, you know, you can just, this is just something to sit down and think about, can either happen sort of to the initial bit sequence, so before you've encoded it, using binary phase shift keying, or sort of post-encoding by, again, producing this chipping sequence, also using binary phase shift keying. So if you encode them both and then multiply them together, then you get your desired signal, or, again, if you exclusive OR them first and then modulate them, you'll get the same thing. Okay. So again, you sort of have the two components. You have your signal and then the chipping code. You combine them, and that gives you your coded, your spread spectrum signal. And in the same way that you have resistance to jamming and noise for the other system, you have it for this system as well. And so now we view our power as being centered around the power of the jamming signal centered around our central frequency for the spread for the BPSK system. And what we've done now again is, nor typically you'd have it within the bandwidth would be related to the rate, sort of inversely proportional to the rate. And what we've done, again, we've increased the rate, and by increasing the rate, we've then increased the bandwidth of the signal. Okay. And so, just as before, either the signal has to now spread its power, or the jamming signal would then have to spread its power over this increased bandwidth in order to achieve the same effect. Okay, so those are sort of your two basic techniques. And they're both great for, again, dealing with noise effects and, you know, if you're interested, dealing with sort of malicious jamming as well. The problem now is that you have increased the bandwidth of your signal, and having done so, you now have to figure out how do you fit multiple signals, or how do you allow multiple signals to share the same bandwidth. Okay, so before, just pardon me while I flip back to, so before you could have viewed each of these subchannels as having a separate signal on it, so each of your WD could have carried a separate narrowband signal. But now, again, that's not the case. Now, you're, for any data stream, your signal is spread over the entire WS. And again, looking at this diagram, it should suggest the possibility for sharing. Obviously, we're still only transmitting at any sort of hop plus signal time. We're still only transmitting on one sort of narrowband frequency. So we can transmit on any of the rest of the frequencies easily, okay? So you could think of accommodating, in this case, four signals by just ensuring that they're not in the same band at any given time. What that means, obviously, is that you have to choose your codes carefully so that they preserve this property of avoiding each other. Where are we? Okay. Okay. And so this is, again, what we need is to have this idea of avoidance. And so if we look at our, we can consider our codes. And so each code is going to, again, represent, if I say here a bit, but a signaling element. And what we need is to keep the codes away from each other at any given time. So we will think of each code as being a vector of length k. And if we're thinking of DSS, we will be, the bit is going to be represented by plus or minus SI, depending on whether it's a 1 or a 0. Okay. So, in the absence of sort of any competing signals, we can think of recovering the signal as sort of being taking the inner product of these code vectors. Okay, So in that case, if you have your chip code SI and you take the, you interproduct it with itself, and when I say interproduct, I mean an exclusive OR, then you're going to get a plus K for a 1 and a, well, you're always going to get plus K. Then if you sort of add the bit in, you can get plus K for a 1 or minus K for a 0. Okay. So that says it's just another way of, it's sort of a slightly mathematical way of representing the chipping code we just looked at. Now, if we have multiple signals, then what we need is different chipping codes, and the codes have to be orthogonal to each other. And so what that means is that if you take the inner product, you get a 0. Okay. And so you should see what that means is we apply one code to a signal if a different receiver, so not the one that's intended for, tries to decode it. It will decode using a different chipping code, and it'll get a 0. It'll say that signal's not for me. Okay. So, ideally, you have sort of complete orthogonality. So, again, if you try and decode with the wrong code, you're going to get a 0. In practice, it might not be completely orthogonal, so there might be, but you can still recover if it's sort of close enough. So probably easiest to, again, look at an example. So here we have three users, and they're all sending the same message, which is a bit strange, but anyway, they are. And so each of those messages is encoded using a different code. So user A uses CA, user B uses CB, user C uses CC. Okay. And so for anyone, you can, that code is just a sequence of bits, and you can use that if just flipping them up and back and forth for either a 0 or a 1. Okay. Now, if you look at it, if you work it out, what you'll see is that CA is orthogonal to CB and CC, but CB and CC are not orthogonal to each other. What we'll see is that despite this, we can still recover our signal from any of them because they're close enough to orthogonal. So now, again, if A wants to transmit a 1, it's sending the code. If it wants to transmit a 0, it's sending minus the code. And in order to recover the signal, again, we're going to take an inner product. So that means just take the exclusive OR of the first element, plus the exclusive OR of the second element, plus the exclusive OR of the third element, up to the exclusive OR of the sixth element. And they're not exclusive ORs. They're just straight multiplication. Sorry about that. Okay, so just multiply the first element elements together, plus the second elements, plus the third elements, plus the fourth elements, plus the fifth elements, plus the sixth elements. And what you do in this case, you'll see that you'll get a 6 if a 1 was sent, and a minus 6 if a 0 was sent. So the two bits are clearly distinguishable. Okay. So, what happens if you get values other than plus or minus 6? Well, either something's gotten flipped in transmission, so there's a transmission error, or someone else is transmitting on a non-orthogonal code. But what you would hope was if one bit was flipped, you might go from plus 6 to plus 5, and you would hope that there would still be sort of sufficient information left to decode your signal to determine which bit it should have been to begin with. You also hope with non-orthogonal codes that they're sort of sufficiently orthogonal, not completely, but sufficiently far apart from each other that they will, you'll still be able to recover the signal. Okay. So, again, if we have a look at what happens when we send multiple signals here, we're assuming that B and A are both transmitting. So the signal that the receiver is going to get is a combination of A's signals and B's signal. Okay. Now, the guy who wants A's signal is going to apply A's chipping code to recover that signal. And doing that, since it's orthogonal to B, you're going to zero this portion out and recover the initial signal. In the case of, directly contradicts what I said earlier, doesn't it? Okay, now CA and CC are orthogonal, I believe. Okay. Sorry about this. This should read CB and CC. The idea anyway is that if your codes are non-orthogonal, then when you go to decode, you will actually pick up some of the other signal. Not all of it, and hopefully only a small proportion of it. Again, if you think, in this case, if our codes are 6 long, then ideally the code itself will give you a 6. If the non-orthogonal code is moving that out by at most plus or minus 2, then it should still be possible to figure out what the original signal is. And I will redo that slide sort of with the proper numbers in it. But again, in the example, if we look back to our original example, as I said before, CA is actually orthogonal to both CB and CC, but CB and CC are not orthogonal to each other. So there's never a problem with CA in terms of recovery of signal, but there is a slight issue with recovering signals between CB and CC. Okay. But again, you're going to be using either CB or CC, you're going to be able to recover a sufficient amount of your original signal, and the additions from the other signal are not going to be enough to change your decision. So I'll rewrite that, and I'll probably post it just in a separate file, but that's the idea. Okay, now, how do you generate the sequences, and what properties do you want your sequences to have? Well, just for the purposes of sort of optimum signaling efficiency and optimum noise avoidance, you want the sequences to be reasonably random. Okay. And in addition to random, you want them to be uniform. Okay. So we want roughly half ones, half zeros. Again, we know it's not great to be signaling a lot of zeros or a lot of ones in a sequence. And so we also want to, within sort of the balance of ones and zeros, again, not to have a lot of big runs of either ones or zeros. Okay. And so the run property says that half the runs should be length one, so you should be flipping between zero and one a lot. A quarter of them are of length 2, an eighth of length 3, etc. So again, you get lower and lower chance of getting longer sequences. Okay. You want your sequence to be unpredictable. Again, if you think of the jamming scenario, then if you can figure out what the sequence is, you know, so can the jammer, and they can do the same thing you are. And you also want a correlation property that says that if you shift the sequence then by one, then you're not correlated. So again, this has to do with if your signal is delayed, you don't want to have interference between two different signals. Okay, and so there's a number of ways to generate these sequences. One common method is a linear feedback shift register. And the benefits of this is that, well, again, it has nice properties. So over a given period, the sequences look very random. And because it's a matter of shifting and exclusive ORing, it can be implemented in hardware. And the idea here is that we have a generator polynomial with coefficients a, 0 through an, or an minus 1, which are sort of picked sort of cleverly, and then an initial value of b0 through bn, and then you use the polynomial, which will again shift around your values to generate your sequence. Okay, and we can show a few properties for these shift registers. They have a maximum period, which is 2 to the n minus 1. So you can again sort of influence the period by just making them bigger or smaller. And you can always get to this maximum period, and you'll never get all zeros unless you started there. Okay. And so this gives you, again, a sequence of a fixed length code, and then which has a certain period. Okay. So just looking at an example, here all our A's are zero except A1, which gives us B3 is B0 plus B1. And so we start out with our initial state, B3 is 1, and the rest are zeros. And so to figure out our new B3, we need to know what B1 exclusive ORed with B0 is. And then, again, you perform a shift. So B0 plus B1 goes into B3, B3 goes into B2, B2 goes into B1, B0, B1 goes into B0. Okay. And our output at any given time, again, is B0. This B0 shifted. Okay. So if we look again, we start out with our initial condition, then we shift everything and move B0 around into, or sorry, B0 plus B1 goes around into the B3 position. And so we continue to do that. Each time we shift, and our value for B0 plus B1 moves into the B3 position, and our value for B0 again is shifted out to the output. Okay. And so what we see again is here n is 4, and indeed after 15, so on our 16th shift, we're back where we started from. So we've produced our sequence, which is, it's a good sequence, and then return to where we started from. Okay, and you can prove a bunch of properties about these sequences that we've produced and that they are what we're looking for. And again, they're good in terms of their correlation properties in that they're not highly correlated except at the periods. Okay. So in general, they're nice. They're not considered good enough, really, to accommodate a lot of users. And so there are various flavors of these sequences, improvements on these types of sequences, which are still, again, hardware generatable, which have somewhat better properties. Okay. Now, another way to deal with this is to sort of directly construct orthogonal codes. So the code, the ones generated again by the shift registers are close to orthogonal, but not there. And so a second technique, which is often used for CDMA systems, where we're worried genuinely more about the sharing aspects, the correlation aspects, than we are about the randomness aspects. So the randomness is nice if you're worried about jamming, because again, it makes it difficult for there's no predicting the code. If you're not worried about that, then it's simpler to just build your own orthogonal codes directly and go ahead and use them. Okay. And so the most common way of doing this is using a Walsh matrix. And so it's generated recursively. You start with something really simple, a 1x1 matrix, and you can expand that out to a 2n matrix by using your initial matrix and then your inserting your values. Okay. Now all of the rows are orthogonal to each other, and they're also orthogonal to the knot of each other, which is nice. Although, again, not surprising. But the shifted versions are not orthogonal. So if you shift by one, then you lose that orthogonality. And so this has to be used in, you have to sort of highly synchronize your system. You can't deal with delay in this sort of a system. Okay, so again, just to take an example, it's quite straightforward. Again, you're plugging in W's all around except in the bottom right-hand corner where you plug in knot of W, and so that gets you to W2, and then W4, you plug in W2, except at the corner where bottom right-hand corner where you plug in the knot, and keep going. And again, you can work out for yourselves that these are indeed not correlated. Okay, and so again, this provides a very explicit way of generating your codes for sharing. It also has an interesting property of you can sort of allow your end users to run at different rates by applying sort of different size codes to each of their signals. And so if an end user, so you look at sort of the minimum rate and then you apply sort of the maximum rate spreading to it, the maximum rate code. If they're running at a higher rate, then you apply a lower rate code. Okay, and so essentially it's evening out the rates of your signaling. And the way you get those codes is by generating your Walsh codes and just taking different dimensions for each. Okay. So that's all we're going to say for spread spectrum. Again, it is used, we'll sort of mention it as we go along, as CDMA being used, spread spectrum being used, and that's the basic gist of how it works. We can take a break now. We'll take about a 15-minute break, and when we return, we will look at the radio channel itself. And again, what are the characteristics of the radio channel that are making it desirable for us to do somewhat complicated things like spread spectrum techniques. So about 15 minutes.